is Bad Boys and Beyond with your hosts, Mike Payton and Keith Black Trudeau.
That's it, baby, I'm foul.
Hey, I'll put it in the front page, back page, middle page, wherever headliners, column one or two, we will win game two. Good back it off, we will win game two.
The game's over and the Pistons have won the world championship.
Welcome back to Bad Boys and Beyond. We are your hosts, Mike Payton and Keith Black Trudeau. We are back again with another episode, and I know we're a little late, but we're going to be talking about the All-Star festivities on this one. More specifically, some of the greatest Pistons moments in All-Star weekend. But we can't really do that until we first do the prerequisite complaining about this year's All-Star weekend. And I'm just going to go ahead and jump right into it because I've been thinking about this all week and been looking forward to the opportunity to have this microphone in front of my face. I am tired of this. Like, All-Star weekend is dead. The only successful and fun part of All-Star weekend was Steph Curry versus Sabrina Ionescu. Did I say her last name right?
I think you're pronouncing it correctly.
Ionescu. That was the only fun part of the entire... I mean, and that was really the only part that everybody watched. The dunk contest was a flop. I don't know what the hell that Jaylen Brown is doing in that dunk contest. Like, he's doing in-game dunks over, like, 5'6" people sitting in chairs. Like, what the hell are you doing? And by the way, guys, we can't all just dunk over someone. You can't just keep bringing people onto the court. Let's all dunk over Shaq this year. It's annoying. Do something. You know, I watch these street dunkers all the time. And look, I understand that it's what you see in these final, you know, videos that these street dunkers put out is probably something that they've been practicing all day. And this is probably their 50th event or 50th attempt or something like that. But for crying out loud, I mean, these, you know, it's fun to watch. There are things that you can do clearly that the NBA refuses to do. And at this point, it's like if you've seen one dunk contest, you've seen them all. Everybody's going to come out there. They're going to try to do a reverse jam. Kenny Smith's going to shit all over it. And it's just horrible. The celebrity game no longer features celebrities. I don't know who half the people out there are. And maybe that's just me getting old, but like, who the hell's Kai Cenat? Like, why should I?
Kai
Cenat. Like, who is this guy? Like, why should I know and care who he is?
I believe he's a Twitch streamer from what I keep hearing. I didn't know who he was either.
Okay, cool. So he's a guy who plays video games for a living and people watch. Is that what it is?
There's more to Twitch than that now, but that's, I think, primarily that's still its main draw.
Well, good for him. That's his thing, and good for him. But I don't know who he is. Like, you know, there used to be like actual celebrity, you know, used to be able to turn this thing on and you'd see Carlton from Fresh Prince going at it with Steve Urkel from Family Matters, and you just knew who those people were. And Mark Wahlberg would be out there for some reason, and you know, it was just, I don't know, maybe I'm just thinking of Rock and Jock, and that's a whole different thing, but I sound like a really old man yelling at a cloud on this celebrity.
Kinda.
But, the one thing I do like is this, the way that they've set up the Rising Stars tournament. I wish that they would maybe give that some more air. Like, if that could be a its own thing on a whole day, like, you know, instead of pairing it also with the celebrity game that day, I just feel like you could get more younger guys involved and it would be a much more fun tournament. But that's just me. And the All-Star game is defenseless. You know, there's just guys it's always been like, you've always known that, hey, this is the All-Star game. Everybody's not going to give it their effort. But there was still a competitive level to it. You know, even not that long ago, there were still, you know, teams wanted to beat the other team. Now everybody just goes out there and does nothing. And the thing I got to complain about the most, and this is going to be my last complaint, Keith, and then I'll let you have the floor. Remember back in the day, you know, gosh, again, I sound like an old man. back in the day, Vince Carter, even just Aaron Glenn, Zach LaVine, just a few years ago, they were doing the dunk contest, and the guys, the fellow players on the sidelines are like losing their minds at everything that's happening. They're excited. They were having a great time. And when you see everybody else having a great time, and you start to have a great time too. I did not see one player on this year's sideline, court side, I should say, that was excited or showed any emotion, or like everybody just sat there. Like, I don't even think anybody stood up at any point in time. And maybe that's because the dunks weren't that great. I don't know. But like, I felt at no point was anybody supporting their colleague or teammate, or it's kind of like, and I liken it to wrestling. Like, if wrestling has a bad crowd, it kind of affects the show. Even if the in-ring product is really great, if nobody's cheering, you kind of like start to feel like it's you're like what you're watching isn't that great. And that same thing happens here, that when everybody is excited, you get excited too. And when everybody's not excited and not showing any emotion, well, then you tend to do the same thing as well. Thoughts, Keith?
Okay, so on that last part, I kind of think it's a chicken or the egg thing, but in this case, I still think that the product on the court, it's their responsibility to get the fans involved, to get the crowd involved. Like even the players that are just watching the game, if it's not exciting, even if you try to force it, these players aren't very good actors, I'm sorry. I don't think it's going to help anything, and I think in some cases it may actually make it worse. You know what my favorite event in the All-Star on All-Star weekend was? And the 3-point contest, the individual one, that I think that was great. I think that was the highlight of the weekend. Not that it was specifically monumental in any way. I just thought it was a great moment for women's basketball and for the NBA, and Kenny Smith did his best to ruin it, but I don't think he did. But aside from that, my favorite event was the celebrity game. Now, and that's something I don't think I'd ever picture myself saying, because the celebrity game has always been, garbage because they bring in people that can't play, and then they try to put on. It becomes like a poor man's version of the All-Star game where they try to just let each other score, and they're not even good at scoring. You mentioned you didn't know who any of these players were, which I think is ironic. You remember Qu seeing Quincy Isaiah? He's the guy that played Magic in Winning Time.
No, you know what? I didn't. I
Yeah,
honestly,
he was actually in the game.
I did not tune. I tuned in, but I've only
Okay.
watched like maybe 10 minutes of it. That's
Yeah,
all.
it was kind of immersion breaking because he's only like 6'2". So
Yeah.
the guy that played Magic is like smaller than everybody else. But my main point is, you know who I did recognize? I recognize Micah Parsons. I recognize Puka Nacua. I recognize CJ Stroud. And you mentioned Kai Cenat. Kai Cenat barely played, and that's because Shannon Sharpe, who was the coach of his team, was putting in guys. He was playing to win. Like they had all these fancy gimmicks. They had this atrocious light up floor. They had a 4-point line. They had an 8-point. Like they had a 2-point bonus time for like 2 minutes each quarter, where every shot was worth double. So the 4-point line turned into an 8-point line. And the funny thing is, Shannon Sharpe was in the huddle. He was mic'd up. He was telling his players during the bonus time, "Do not take the 4-pointers. Go for layups." This is the big Ruffles, like the Ruffles branded 4-point line. He's telling his players specifically to avoid it, which was good strategy because the layups are worth 4 points. It doesn't really matter if you have an 8-point line. Like if you just keep getting 4-point layups every time down the court, you're going to pile up points. But what I really appreciated most about that game is because the players tried. Like you had NFL players, and then there were some WNBA players in the court as well. I want to give credit to them. You had Ron Artest, who, grossly out of shape as he was, does not know the meaning of the word quit. He actually knocked somebody down, I forget who, to stop a fast break at half court, and I thought it was hilarious. But the point is that was an entertaining game. Like the NFL players on both sides kind of led the way, but their aggression kind of bled down to everyone else. And it was a really competitive game. And the coaches, for that reason, played the players that could actually play. So, like, I came away so pleasantly surprised by that game. And it was just a microcosm of this is all we need. These aren't NBA players or NBA caliber players on the court. These are guys that excel in different walks of life. Some of them aren't even athletes for a living. But they tried hard, and that's really all we need out of the All-Star game. We don't need guys giving superhuman performances or taking charges or diving on the floor. We just need effort. Just two teams giving effort, trying to beat each other. And if you do that, eventually those extra hustle plays are going to come naturally because you're going to see a loose ball and damn it, I don't want to lose this possession. I'm going to try a little bit harder for this one. Or, that guy's going to the basket. I really don't want to give up 2 points here. Let me contest the shot. That's all that's going to happen. But look, I complained enough about the All-Star game last year, so I'm going to keep it brief with this year's version. I think the most depressing thing during the game was when Dame Lillard started getting hot and lining up shots. And he is probably, no, he is statistically the most prolific deep shooter in NBA history. Steph is great at getting his shots because he's great with moving without the ball, but his shots generally come within 5 feet of the 3-point line. Dame has lined up a bunch of them like from 30 to 35 feet. And in the All-Star game, he was pulling up from the logo. And these were generally impressive shots. And all I could think of was these shots don't really matter. Like he couldn't get the crowd going because it was like 80 to 64 in the second quarter, and no one was trying to contest the shot. So I'm like, okay, Dame pulled up from half court. That's great. Then the very next possession, some guy is going to get a wide open three from the corner. It's going to be worth the same amount of points. Like that burst from Dame that earned him the MVP when it could have gone to anybody. But it was just so disheartening for me because that should have been a signature moment in it maybe an All-Star game history where a guy was pulling up from low and taking logo shots time and time again, but it had no impact on the game because it wasn't a real game because neither team was trying to win. And the final score was like 290 whatever. So hitting, three or four threes in a row was just a drop in the bucket. Who cares? But I don't know. That was kind of the inverse for me because I really wanted to enjoy that moment and I just couldn't. And I could tell a lot of the fans in the arena, maybe they didn't know why, but they kind of felt the same way where, man, we should be getting excited about this, but yeah, we're not because this isn't like a real game.
Yeah, I think that just like I said last year, I think that the All-Star game has to be for something. I don't know what that is, but I think it need like the winning team gets to get something, whether that's home court advantage or a hefty donation to a charity of their choice or
Don't do
something.
that because they did that donation thing before. Money does not impact a damn thing. You
Okay.
remember they did that like 4 or 5 years ago where they kept score by the quarter and every whatever team won every quarter would go to so and so's favorite charity, the certain pot of money, and it didn't really matter. Like they still didn't care. And I hear that rumblings from I guess anonymous players that man, if they get paid more, maybe they would try harder. I'm all for players getting what they're w worth and maximizing their value, but screw you. The starting lineups of both these teams combined to make like 300 million this. If that's not enough, if you need like an extra 50,000 or 100,000 or even 1 million to get you to try hard in a game that's meant as a showcase for the fans that allow you to make the insane amounts of money that you do for a living, if you need to be paid more on top of that. That is a horrible, horrible, like you aren't minimum salary guys. You guys are all, almost everyone in that court was a maximum salary player. If you need more money to show appreciation for the people that pay your salaries, I think that's a horrible look. And I think that the NBA tried to offer a bigger pot of money. I think it would backfire horribly because what does that say about the state of the league and the players themselves? That they cannot be bothered to try. I agree with your incentive point. I just don't want to hear the word money being thrown out. I really don't. Not in this instance.
All right. Yeah, that's fair. Well then, Yeah, I really just think that it would be something like home court advantage in the finals or
Yeah, like
play or something.
baseball
Yeah.
did.
But yeah. Well, let's get to what we're here to talk about today, and that's all-star moments in Pistons history. And I want to start with something that I didn't really know about. We're going to go back to the 70s here because we got Keith on the show, and you know that Keith lives in the
Okay.
olden days. But the one-on-one tournament.
Yeah, so the NBA actually for a couple of years, and I hear this constantly on Twitter, that man, the NBA should go to a one-on-one contest. Okay, well, the NBA has actually done this before, and you can actually see a lot of these on YouTube still. I checked yesterday. The most prominent one was held in 1972. Technically not an all-star event. It was held throughout the season at halftime of various NBA contests. The finals were held during, I think, game five of the NBA finals at halftime. But it was basically you're straight up one and one. It was interesting because they had, once you got possession in the half court, you have to take it back to check it. So they had a what resembles a 3-point line today. It wasn't worth three, but it's interesting in 1972 to see a 3-point or an arch around an NBA court. So it was your basic first to 20 wins. You had to win by four because each basket was worth 2 points. The interesting wrinkle I thought, which was it's pretty interesting, is you had a referee, which isn't unheard of for a one-on-one contest, but the referee was also calling shooting fouls. I want to say it was after your first three fouls. A player gets in the bonus and then he gets awarded a free throw. So reason I bring up this first tournament, it was a $15,000 grand prize, which for an NBA player back in 1972 was actually a good bit of money. So it was very competitive. And the eventual champion of this first contest was Piston center Bob Lanier. And I have a list of the it was a big bracket. Every team in the league got, I think, one participant. I think the second year they had two per team. I think that's how it went. I could be wrong. But the first round was actually Bob Lanier versus Pete Maravich, which I wish I could have seen, but I haven't been able to find it. But Lanier beat Pete Maravich in the first round. Paul Silas, borderline Hall of Fame power forward, beat him in the second round. Mike Riordan and Mike Newland, who no one listening has probably ever heard of, but he beat those two in the next two rounds. And then in the finals, he faced off against JoJo White, who was a Hall of Fame point guard for the Boston Celtics. Now, JoJo White, well known as an excellent defender and actually pretty big for his time. He was like 6'3", 200 some pounds. But Bob Lanier went about 6'11", 260. And I think there was a 10-second shot clock. So I don't, it wasn't really possible for Lanier to just back JoJo White down and lay the ball in over his head. But he was big enough and he was mobile and quick enough to where JoJo White couldn't really press up against him either because Lanier did have the handles to go around you. We will get into a Lanier episode at some point because he's one of my all-time favorite players, because he was so incredibly skilled. But current day, I would compare him to DeMarcus Cousins, like in his prime. DeMarcus, he had that type of skill set where he was big, strong, agile, and he had range out to 20 some feet. He was that highly skilled. So for him to, in a one-on-one contest is almost cheating. And JoJo made a good show of it, but I think Lanier went up by 10 points early because JoJo, I think Lanier might have missed one shot. He might have missed one. The rest of the time, all JoJo could do was foul him. It was either Lanier beating him with an up and under, Lanier beating him with fadeaway, Lanier just hooking the ball over his head, or Lanier getting fouled and making free throws. Like that was the entire, it did not last long. And Bill Russell was calling the game, and he had this great comment at the start. He said, "I think JoJo has two chances to win this, slim and none." And Bill Russell, who actually didn't play against Lanier, they were a couple years apart, but he was absolutely right because Lanier dominated. They had this contest one more time in 1973, And I don't know if it was I think it was canned because of lack of popularity, but also the NBA Players Association was I think funding some of the pot for this, so I think the Players Association kind of shut it down as well, because I'm guessing enough players got sick of funding a pot that they couldn't win.
I think this is something that would probably be, this would have been huge in the 80s or the 90s
It
with
would
like
have,
Michael
yes.
Jordan versus, you know, who Michael Jordan versus Isaiah. They could have just solved it all right there on the court. You know, that sort of thing. I think it could probably be somewhat big today as well. Just, you know, some of the bigger names in the NBA, like Luka why am I blanking on the MVP of the league's name right now?
Oh, the current MVP?
From the Nuggets, sorry.
Oh, no, he's not the current. You mean Nikola Jokic, but
Yeah,
the current
Jokic,
MVP
sorry.
is Joel Embiid.
Yeah, Luka versus Jokic, you know, those two were clowning each other all week on Twitter. You could see it. It would be cool as to maybe have some build up like that on social media, and then, you know, on Friday or Saturday you get that one-on-one game.
Yeah.
And you know, something like that, you
You
know, that would be a spectacle.
Yeah, as an aside, you know, they did actually have two different one-on-one pay-per-view events set up that neither of them actually happened, but they were both heavily advertised. You remember? All right, there was Julius Erving versus Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Like, this is like just after they retired. Actually, I think that one did happen. I don't think anyone watched it, but the big event, Taco Bell sponsored the heck out of this. It was a pay-per-view event. I want to say 94, 93, or no, 94, 95. It was Hakeem Olajuwon versus Shaq. And it was supposed to be this big summer, like $1 million prize, pay-per-view event. They hyped it up like you would a boxing match. Like the advertisements were everywhere on every Taco Bell. And it was one of those like overhyped boxing matches that you knew was never going to happen because someone was going to pull out. And yeah, I think Hakeem eventually pulled out of it. But it was just one of those like, man, this would be cool if it happened, but I don't think either of these players really wants it to happen. It was just a big promotional event for nothing.
No, I don't remember that one either, but yeah. No, I think that's something that could, like, if they tried it today, it would maybe work a little bit better. But yeah, that's the one-on-one. Let's try another competition, the 3-point competition. What kind of history do
Okay,
the Pistons have there?
so one thing about the 3-point competition and the slam dunk competition, the Pistons have never fared well in either one. They've never been prevalent in either one. So the 3-point contest, the Pistons have had three participants. One of them was in it twice. The first one we're going to get to is Terry Mills in 1997. Mind you, the NBA 3-point contest had been going on. I think this was the 12th season. This is the first time with the Detroit Piston. And what's notable here is that this is the first year where any true big man was ever selected for the 3-point contest. And we actually had two this year. We had Terry Mills and Sam Perkins. And it was not a banner year for big men in this contest because both Terry Mills and Sam Perkins, if you ever watched them play, you know their releases, even though they had deep range, their releases were slow as hell. So asking them both to rattle off like 25 shots inside of like a minute, it was not going to end well, and it didn't. Terry Mills only wound up with 11 points, and the only reason he didn't come in last was because Sam Perkins finished with 8. Look, I still think it was a great moment because this is the first year the NBA recognized that centers could also shoot threes, but they picked the two worst possible centers to compete in this contest. All right, so flash forward 7 years. Chauncey Billups makes his first appearance. I did watch this one. He clanked, I think, all but one money ball, which kind of buried him. He wound up with just 12 points, finished 5th place out of 6 contestants. He was back a couple years later, finished with roughly the identical performance, finished with 12 points again. Tied for last with Detroit Pistons legend and former assistant coach Quentin Richardson. And 2 years later, we had our final Pistons selection to the 3-point contest. 16 years prior to this broadcast, No Piston since then. Do you remember which Piston it was?
Oh, what year? Say it again.
2008.
2008.
Was not Billups, obviously, because he already had his
Right.
two.
Was it Brandon Jennings?
It 2008.
2008. No.
He had just led the NBA in 3-point percentage the year before.
Oh God. I don't remember. I'm
It
totally
was
blanking
actually
on this
Richard
one.
Hamilton,
Ah, Rip. Okay.
who had kind of developed. It was kind of, I don't want to say it was a fake percentage, but he had kind of developed himself into a corner three specialist. So he was outstanding at making the closer ones. Still not great at the above the break threes, but this was only notable not because of Rip Hamilton, but he actually scored 14, which again was good for second to last, but. The notable part about this contest was Steve Nash. I think he had like something like six or seven. Like he had maybe the worst 3-point contest I have ever seen. Finished dead last. It's just uncomfortable to look at because he just like yeah, I think he airballed a couple of them. He just was not ready for this at all.
Well, then the dunk contest, again, as you had mentioned, nobody's really fared well in that. Not even Darvin Ham, who wasn't quite a Piston yet, but still, I don't know why I even brought him up, but I always remember him going up against Kobe, and that was, to me, that's still my favorite dunk contest. And I know everybody else would pick Vince Carter or Zach LaVine and Aaron Gordon, but that Kobe Bryant one is still my favorite.
Okay,
It
so
is. I saw the look on your face. It's just because it's sentimental to me. That's
okay,
why I
I don't
picked
know. I know. I just most
it.
people remember that as the worst dunk contest of all time.
I just, I
Just
was
simply like all the scores were insanely low.
right. I just remember watching it with my parents and feeling happy and good. And I
Yeah, the one
just
in
really,
Cleveland.
right.
Like it's a good Kobe memory because he didn't win
Yeah.
it, but like in most other years, he probably wouldn't have advanced past the first round with the dunks that he pulled.
Right.
All right. So the very first dunk contest participant, again, 10 years after its inception, the very first Piston to enter was 1994 rookie named Allen Houston. And already, if you didn't know this already, you're already thinking that this is probably not going to end well because Houston is almost always known as a shooter. But he was a track and field high jumper in high school. He was a dunk contest champion in high school. And for a guard, he was big. He was like 6'5", 6'6". So it's not like he couldn't do some stuff. But basically, and this was one of those weird years where they just gave you like a minute or 90 seconds or whatever to show off what you can do. It wasn't graded on one dunk necessarily. So Allen Houston's around. He basically just kept lobbing the ball to himself, off his head, off the backboard, behind the back, off the backboard, bouncing off the ground to a reverse dunk. Like it was, they weren't bad, but they were all very basic dunks, even for 1994. Overall, he graded himself a 41.5, which was it was actually very close to advancing to the finals, which was won by J.R. Ryder, who did that East Bay funk that everyone still duplicates today, the between the legs dunk. But it was probably the most successful dunk contest any Piston has ever had, even though it was the very definition of mediocre. Now, 6 years later, when the NBA All-Star game, after taking a year off because of the lockout, comes back to San to I think it was still Oakland back then, but the Bay Area, California, and both Jerry Stackhouse and Grant Hill were they were both having career seasons. They were both All-Stars that year, and Jerry Stackhouse was in the dunk contest. But the problem was the order that they put him in. They put him in directly after a certain Toronto Raptors second year player by the name of Vince Carter. And Vince Carter, who everyone still remembers today, put on one of the most dominating slam dunk performances of all time, where it was over after the, as Kenny Smith keeps telling people today, it was over after the second dunk because he called the stupid thing. And he's been living off of that for 24 years. Anyway. So, Jerry Stackhouse's dunks actually weren't bad. He did a two-hand 360 on his first attempt. Which after Vince Carter's reverse one hand spinning 360 power dunk, everyone was just kind of asleep. The funny thing was the cameras almost missed it because they were still interviewing Vince Carter while Jerry Stackhouse was dunking.
I think if he had gone before, he would have had a few more points, but
Just no one had a chance against Vince Carter, and whoever was going up after Vince Carter definitely didn't have a chance, and that was Jerry.
his second attempt, he brought Grant Hill out, and Grant Hill.
How it was Grant Hill would stand in front of the charge circle, bounce the ball high in the air, and then kneel down so Jerry could dunk over him. It didn't really work out, but what I thought was incredibly dumb about what Kenny Smith said was Grant Hill is definitely not the passer on that team. I don't know if that was meant tongue in cheek or if Kenny just had really never seen Grant Hill play before. I don't know.
But yeah, that
He was
I
on the
thought.
team with Grant Hill the year before.
Well, 3 years before,
Three
yeah,
yeah,
in
three years. Oh
1997, yeah,
3 years
in the
before.
Teals, yeah. But yeah, how it boiled down was Jerry eventually finished fourth out of six contestants simply because I think Ricky Davis missed both of his dunks. He finished with a 30, which was like the minimum score. And yeah, Larry Hughes didn't do much bad. I think he missed one of his, and the second one was, I forget what it was, but it wasn't memorable. But yeah, but Jerry Stackhouse will always be remembered in that contest for the guy that followed out Vince Carter and nothing else. All right, so we've had one more Piston in the dunk contest. That was 8 years ago in 2016. That was Andre Drummond. And
It is really hard for players that are really tall to look impressive dunking a basketball. I know Dwight Howard pulled it off. Larry Nance pulled it off. But for the most part, it makes it look way too easy, and it's not exciting.
to Andre Drummond's credit, he did try some tricks. He did where he was standing way out of bounds in the baseline and tried to do a reverse dunk through the legs, which if he had landed it would have been it might have been a 50. But after screwing it up twice, he had to settle for doing the same dunk but with a basic reverse dunk, not between the legs. I think he wound up with a 36 because he had missed the first two, so the judges kind of punished him for the third one. And then the second one,
He tried to get creative. He brought out Steve Nash, and Steve Nash, soccer enthusiast, grew up in Canada, tried to do some kicking tricks, tried to kick him a lob with a, but the problem is that just makes Steve Nash look impressive. It doesn't make Andre Drummond look impressive. So even though they pulled it off, the judges
I think gave, yeah, they gave.
Andre a 39, I think just because he pulled it off on the first real try.
But in any case, Drummond still didn't finish last, though.
He came in third out of four. So if there's anything we've learned about Pistons in the dunk and the 3-point contest, they do not finish last. They don't advance, but they never finish last.
Well, if you're not first, you're last, as our old friend Ricky Bobby would say. Let's talk about the rising stars. For me, I think the thing that always comes to mind is besides Cade obviously winning the MVP, which we'll talk about, and excuse me, Brandon Knight versus Kyrie Irving in a little bit of a cross off.
Yeah, not really a highlight.
I
Well,
thought it
not
was great.
really.
I thought it was great until Kyrie clearly showed Brandon that he was the better crosser.
Yeah, I was thinking about this a while ago. Well, actually, I was thinking about this last night watching Ben Mathurin and Jaden Ivey, where Ben Mathurin, every time he plays the Pistons, he tries way, way, way too hard, like to the point where he's like breaking his team's offense to show up Jaden Ivey, and he winds up doing stupid stuff. And that's kind of how Brandon Knight and Kyrie Irving were. They were the two first 2 point guards selected in, I think, the 2012 NBA draft. And anytime that Brandon Knight would go up against Kyrie Irving, he would play his at he would outplay Kyrie Irving, at least for the first couple of years, because he would play it like it was the game seven of the NBA Finals. He was playing really hard, and after a while, it was like it. It's just because that Brandon Knight has a chip on his shoulder and Kyrie Irving really doesn't give a damn because, the Cavs were bad. No one cares. And that's kind of how I felt watching Jaden Ivey and Ben Mathurin last night, where Ben Mathurin was trying to make a point. Jaden Ivey was, not that he wasn't trying, he was just playing a normal game. He didn't play very long. He didn't get a lot of opportunities, but he wasn't trying to force it either. He didn't feel like he had a point to prove. It was all Ben Mathurin. And that's kind of how Brandon Knight and Kyrie Irving were. Until Brandon Knight tried to show Kyrie Irving during the Rising Stars event with the nation watching. And then Kyrie Irving took it seriously and crossed him over to the point where he fell down and then hit a three over his head.
So there have been 16 Detroit Pistons named to the Rising Stars competition. Well, 21 selections, 16 of them in like individual, like six of them went twice when they went to the rookie sophomore thing. So here's the list. I'm just going to run it down real quick. Lindsey Hunter, Mateen Cleaves. Yes, Mateen Cleaves. Jelko Rabacho, which is utterly hilarious because I think he was 29 years old at the time. One of my favorites. Tayshaun Prince, Rodney Stuckey, Jonas Jurepko, Greg Monroe, Brandon Knight, Andre Drummond, Kentavious Caldwell-Pope. Svi Mykhailiuk went, yeah, as a Detroit Piston. Isaiah Stewart, Cade Cunningham, Sadiq Bey, Jaden Ivey, and Jalen Duren. Now, the Pistons have had actually a lot more success in this event, probably because they've had a lot more participants. But Andre Drummond actually was the MVP of the 2014 Rising Stars game. Pulled down like 20-some rebounds. He was a typical Andre performance. And I think part of what made him look so impressive is because it was a game where no one was really trying to foul. So it's not like you had hack a Drummond going on. So his biggest weakness was never exposed. So he was allowed to just physically dominate everybody, which he did. And Cade Cunningham, which I know you remember this one, Mike. 2 years ago, he was the MVP of the 2022 Rising Stars event, which is actually pretty cool because there were a lot of fairly talented players around him. But you could see that the players on the court were deferring to Cade to make the right decisions, which was made me feel really good about Cade moving forward. He wasn't the leading scorer necessarily, but he was the guy that was directing everything.
I still feel really good about Cade, even after last night's debacle in Indiana.
He was dominating. It wasn't his debacle.
I know. He was great. He's really the only player I feel very good about.
But so, that's yeah. Here nor there. Well, it isn't, but it is at the same time. I do feel really good about most of the players that are still on the team that they've drafted. It's just the everything else I don't feel so great about. I don't feel so great about the depth, the bench, or the coaching staff, quite frankly, or the general manager or the owner. That's a lot of obstacles for even Cade Cunningham to overcome. All right, but moving on. I want to address this briefly because the skills competition, well, a great idea. Hockey has been doing skills competitions for decades, and it's like the most entertaining event aside from the game itself. Because it showcases, you know, the stars showing exactly. It's like a track and field competition on ice. It's outstanding. And I'm not even a huge hockey fan. But the NBA tried to mimic that, and they keep tweaking it, and it keeps failing miserably.
The first Piston to participate was actually Brandon Knight as a rookie in 2013. How did he do? Well, it was a team event. The East won. His team won. But did he do extremely? He was kind of in the middle.
Andre Drummond, the multi-skilled Andre Drummond, believe it or not, participated in 2018 as hard as it on the big man team. I forget who else. I think Karl Anthony Towns and someone else was on it with him.
They didn't come in last, but I think they came in second to last. Lauri Markkanen. I think.
It was a tournament. I was reading my notes wrong. It was actually a tournament style in 2018, so it was a one-on-one. But Andre was paired up with Lauri Markkanen in the first round. Markkanen eliminated him barely. But Andre, I thought, did pretty well.
2022, that this was when they went back to the team competition. Cade was part of the all-rookie team. But this was when they kind of turned it into a joke because you had the Antetokounmpo brothers, you know, competing year after year. And they would come in last place year after year because even Giannis is not very well suited for that competition. And his brothers really aren't NBA caliber players. So I thought it turned the
skills competition into kind of a joke. And then the final time a Piston participated was actually last year. Jaden Ivey this time was part of the all-rookie team.
And again, they finished second to last, and the Antetokounmpos finished last.
I don't know about you, but I've been seeing a lot of Thanasis highlights put up on Twitter lately. So I think that guy, I don't know, NBA ready, maybe. We'll see. I think the NFL does a pretty good job of the skills competition too. Or at least they did in the 90s. I don't know if you remember like the quarterback competitions that they would have. Yeah. But stuff like that is always fun. I think you're right. I think they change it way too much in the NBA. And they got guys out there who, you know, just don't really care that much. It's just, I think they just need to find a way to play it up as, you know, where there's feuds, where guys really want to beat each other. And I didn't see that from any of the competitors this year.
All right. But, and then go ahead.
Well, I was just going to move us to the game itself, to the All-Star game itself.
Yeah. I was afraid you'd do that. Cause we have one more event to cover. We had discussed this. Yeah. We discussed this before we started the very obscure and short-lived, but very Piston-centric Rising Stars event.
Shooting Stars event. So the Shooting Stars, and I think they only had this for a couple of seasons. It was basically a team around the world event where you had a team of three players, one current NBA player, one retired NBA player, and one WNBA player. And you would all be at a certain station, you know, they'd be stationed set up on the baseline, top of the arc three-pointer, corner three-pointer, elbow shot. There'd be, I think, five or six stations set up. And one player would shoot a rack of balls until they made one. And then the next player would shoot from their rack. It was not a free-for-all. It was very specific. You had to, one person goes and the other, next teammate goes and the next teammate goes until you made all of the racks. And then you would all go to half court and first person to hit a half court shot, and that would finish your time.
So in this current in this event was happening in 2007 in Las Vegas. It was cool because Vegas did not have an NBA team, so they brought over Mason, the Detroit Pistons public address announcer, to MC the whole thing. It was so perfect. So the three participants in this game were Chauncey Billups, Bill Laimbeer, I think, who was like pushing 50, 55 at that time, and Swin Cash of the Detroit Shock. And they advanced to the finals, and they put together a decent time. They struggled to hit the half-court shot. Chauncey, I think, made his after the third or fourth attempt.
And they were up against, of course, in the finals, the Chicago team of Candace Dupree from the Chicago WNBA team. I forget their name. Ben Gordon.
And Scottie Pippen. And they actually, they struggled to hit their racks. And the problem was, I want to say Candace, before she could finish her rack, Ben Gordon started shooting his. And that disqualified them. So even though I think Pippen hit his first half-court shot and they finished with a time, I think, 1 or 2 seconds ahead of the Detroit team, they were disqualified because Ben Gordon did not follow the rules. So, yeah, but look, had he followed the rules, they would not have finished with a better time anyway because he attempted his shot before his teammate finished hers. So it wouldn't have mattered. But yeah, the lasting impression of that contest is Bill Laimbeer, Swin Cash, and Chauncey Billups in front of the mic holding the trophy,
giving a Detroit basketball chant to the boos, the loud boos of an entire crowd of people at Las Vegas. Most of them, I'm assuming, are Lakers fans. It was possibly my favorite moment of this century of All-Star Weekend as far as the Detroit Pistons are concerned.
And it's really the only competition that we've won. So,
well, there's the Rising Stars, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, but like that's a, you know, that was an individual award. I guess, yeah, you know what I mean. That's the only, yep. Like, we never won a dunk contest. We've never won a 3-point contest. But here we are. We've won this contest that the NBA almost swiftly got rid of shortly after that. They're probably thinking, well, Bill Laimbeer's winning this thing, so we need to get rid of it.
I don't know if I'd go that far.
No, that's probably not. But, yes, the game itself.
So just to start it out, I'm simply going to go over the years that are notable from a Pistons perspective. 1974, held in Seattle. Bob Lanier came off the bench, won MVP of the contest, had 24 points, 10 rebounds, 2 blocks, 2 steals. And God help me, this is the one All-Star game from the 1970s that I cannot find a tape of. It kills me to this day. It's one of Bob Lanier's, you know, signature performances for a guy that was never involved heavily in the playoffs. This is his one time on a national stage where he dominated, and there's just like, it's typical Lanier. There's no film of him in his prime, and it annoys me to no end. 10 years later, and this goes down in many people's books, as the most entertaining All-Star game of all time. It was held in Denver, in the thin air of Denver, Colorado, 1984. East versus West. The West had a 76-62 lead at halftime, and it was kind of your typical All-Star fair where, like, it was a lot of fast breaks and it was entertaining, but the teams weren't trying. They hadn't turned it up yet. And then Isaiah Thomas, who had no points at halftime, decides to turn it up, and it turns into one of the greatest point guard duels of all time between he and Magic Johnson. Isaiah scores 21 points in the second half, finishes with 15 assists, I think 5 steals. He was a defensive menace in the second half, playing the passing lanes, pressuring the ball. Ended up Magic's game, too. Magic finished with 15 points and 22 assists, which to this day is an All-Star game record. And I don't think Isaiah subbed out the entire second. Like, his competitiveness was driving the entire game to the point where Casey Jones, the Celtics coach, decided, I'm just not going to take Isaiah out. Isaiah Thomas, even though this was an overtime game, but Isaiah Thomas played 39 minutes in an All-Star game. I don't think any player has ever played 39 minutes in an All-Star game since. That is how critical he was, not only to the East's comeback win, but to that game being as great as it was. So it goes into overtime. Isaiah does score a couple in overtime, but he also sets the table for both Dr. J and Andrew Toney from the Sixers. The East scores like 22 points in the overtime. But it was mainly Isaiah just making everything happen. And he was putting up some incredible passes where he would get into the lane and find guys that I don't even watching it on film, I didn't realize they were open until he threw the ball. Just a great, great performance. And Isaiah Thomas was rightfully named MVP of that All-Star game. But it's not just him. It was the fact that it was him and Magic just going back and forth. The final score was East 154, West 135. All right. So, excuse me, 145. All right. So a couple years later, I want to also mention that Isaiah had two teammates in that 84 All-Star game. Kelly Trepiuka, who barely played, I think he scored 1 point. And Bill Laimbeer, who was actually in it as a replacement for Moses Malone. And he was arguably the best center on the court. which makes sense considering he and Isaiah were teammates. They understood each other's game. He was moving great without the ball. I think he played 17 minutes. He had 13 points, 5 rebounds, a couple blocks. He was big in that second half as well. So Isaiah Thomas, 2 years later, shows up to Dallas for the 86 All-Star game by himself, no teammates this time.
More of a scoring mode this time around. Scores 30 points, 10 assists, 5 more steals. It's
a close game until the fourth quarter, and then he kind of comes in, and again, like he did in 84 in the fourth quarter, takes over the scoring, and the East kind of pulls away. But Isaiah Thomas, for the second time in 3 years, is named MVP of the All-Star game. And no Detroit Piston has been named MVP since.
Well, that is, I mean, I guess it's kind of understandable, though, because, you know, it's Michael Jordan and Shaq and, you know, Kobe and all that since then. They're much bigger stars. Isaiah was easily one of the biggest stars in basketball in the 80s. Yep. I don't think the Pistons have really had a star as big as him ever since then. Maybe Grant?
Grant. I would put Grant. I don't think Grant was as good of a player as Isaiah Thomas. I would never say that. But in terms of star power, I think he was very close for a number of years.
Ben Wallace, I think, was really locally, big there for a minute.
Well, yeah, locally, Ben Wallace was huge.
He got the cover of the video game, and he was in commercials. He was a big deal there for.
Yeah, I also want to throw in Dennis Rodman, who made the All-Star team. The only two times in his career he went to the All-Star game was in Detroit. Both times he brought Joe Dumars and Isaiah Thomas along as teammates. So the Pistons had 3 All-Stars twice in 3 seasons. And the second time Rodman played, I think, 15 minutes had 13 rebounds. It was just one of those. He had by far the most rebounds of any player in the game, and he barely played more than a quarter.
The final All-Star memory, which you brought up before we started our notes on this. So if you want to take this one away,
well, it's 2006. I mean, this was basically the entire Pistons team, starting lineup, I should say, checking into the game almost at one point. It was something very special to see, you know. This is a team that obviously Chauncey, Rip, Ben, Rashid, it was incredible. And I don't think that you're going to see that a lot, because it's also not just a team having multiple All-Stars, but it's a team having All-Stars with that, you know, like, these guys were not big superstars. That's the point I'm trying to get to here. I'm fumbling my words a little bit, but these guys were considered like role players everywhere else. They come to Detroit, they become this unbelievable championship winning basketball team, and now they're all-stars, you know, and guys, like I said, that I think they would be number twos in other areas, and here they are, they're number ones, and they're all-stars, and they're all checking into the game at the same time. It's just... It was huge. It was huge for Pistons. I think it's the last time I felt happy.
So, yeah, going into the All-Star break, the Pistons were something like 40-6 or some odd. They were on a ridiculous pace, a 70-win pace up until the last month of the season. The 2006 Pistons were still – they finished with, I want to say just in quotes, just 64 wins, but it's still the most in franchise history for one season. And as a reward, 4 Pistons got sent to the All-Star game. The obvious ones, Ben Wallace, Rasheed Wallace, Rip Hamilton, and Chauncey Billups. I know there was a push to send Tayshaun Prince, which was kind of ridiculous because I think you're overdoing it at that point. But the pinnacle moment, as you said, was not – I don't think it was just the 4 Pistons checking in at once, because they were all reserves. None of them were voted in by the fans. It was the fact what they did once they got into the game. So the West was dominating. The East was in the middle of a comeback, 20-point comeback, and I think they were down like still like 7, 8, 9 points by the time these 4 players checked in. And it was those 4. Do you remember who the small forward was in the lineup?
I don't.
It was Paul Pierce. Oh. And I absolutely felt sorry for Paul Pierce because he was just doing cardio for like 5 minutes, because you could tell, like, even though the West team, which had like Kevin Garnett and Tim Duncan and Pau Gasol and Kobe and whatever, like, but they were doing like, the Pistons had the advantage of having played together and didn't know what, no, like, these are the plays that we run. They were running half-court offense, like, in an all-star game, like, by them. They were coaching themselves. And poor Paul Pierce had no idea what was going on. He was just standing in a corner. But it was the fact that they outscored the West team. Like, they checked in. They were down, like, 7 or 8. And then they checked. By the time they checked out, the East was up 5 or 6. And they were forcing multiple shot clock violations. And Ben Wallace was blocking shots. Rasheed Wallace was blocking shots. They were generating fast breaks off of defense. And it's this quintessential moment where Marv Albert's calling the game and they force a turnover. And it's, I think, I want to say it was Billups on running down the middle. I think it was Ben Wallace on the left wing. And Rip Hamilton on the right, or Rasheed Wallace on the right, and Marv Albert's ready to say, it's a 3-on-1 break for the Pistons, and he stops himself. But you could clearly see that's where it was going, because it really was. And it was this – it's the greatest, I think, Pistons, pure Pistons moment in the history of the main All-Star game, even though none of them won MVP. LeBron won MVP because, of course, he did. He had the numbers. The East came back and won, but it was the fact that – you had a Detroit Pistons, four-fifths of the Detroit Pistons starting lineup on the court in an all-star game, and they were outplaying the Western Conference badly. They had advantages, obviously, but it was still one of the, like, wow, this is really the team that represents Detroit right now. This is insane.
All right. So, but before we wrap this up, I do want to get to one last topic. It'll be a brief topic because there's not too much to go over, but it's the history of the Detroit Pistons hosting the All-Star game. And the very first time, and also the very last time that it was held in within the Detroit city limits was 1959. This was the second year that the Detroit Pistons called Detroit home. It was held in Olympia Stadium. The West, which, by the way, keep in mind, the Western Conference was the Pistons Conference at this time, so the West was the home team. The West won 124-108. It was a co-MVP year. Elgin Baylor, who was a rookie at that time, of the Minneapolis Lakers, and Bob Pettit of the Atlanta Hawks, they came away with co-MVPs. But what makes this game notable to me was George Yardley came in, had 6 points, 4 rebounds. But that's not the entire story of it. The Pistons were actually trying to trade George Yardley, but they would not dare trade him before they hosted the All-Star game. So almost immediately after this, the Pistons played in one more game. Yardley was buried on the bench. He played like 5 minutes, scored like 1 point, and then he was traded the next day. So this was really George Yardley's farewell to Detroit, this game right here. Because yeah, like,
he and Pistons management had enough of each other, and it was this long drawn out process, because they knew they were hosting an All-Star game and they didn't want to trade their team's biggest star before the All-Star game happened. So it was one of those like unhappy marriages where you're just waiting for the divorce papers to get finalized.
That is insane. That's so surprising they didn't actually just trade him, you know, directly after the game.
Yeah, you would think so, right?
So the other time that the Pistons hosted the All-Star game, outside of Detroit in the Pontiac Silverdome,
which the Detroit Pistons called home for 10 years at one point.
I believe this was the very first – I think this was actually the first season the Pistons were playing in the Silverdome, 78-79. So –
what makes this game notable is it's actually the first All-Star game ever held in a dome. It is the first All-Star game featuring no Boston Celtics. Very, very odd things, but they're notable, I think. Once again, the Pistons were in the Western Conference still at this point, so they were the West was – this was a home game for the West.
The Western Conference won 134-129.
David Thompson, who has always had great games in the Silverdome in his career. I think he had, I think his 70, I think his 70 point, 71 point game was, I think, also against the Pistons in the Silverdome.
He came away with the MVP with 25
points, even though he was the third leading scorer, his team won. So,
Bob Lanier, in his final All-Star game appearance as a member of the Detroit Pistons, played 31 minutes off the bench, which couldn't have been great for his knees, but I applaud the effort. 10 points, 4 rebounds, 4 assists. And the Pistons have not hosted an All-Star game since 1979, which is just as much in, part of the NBA not wanting to come to Detroit because the infrastructure, they don't have the hotels set up yet. The District Detroit is kind of a blight right now. I'll rephrase it. It's an embarrassment.
Yeah.
So I don't think you can really hold any kind of event there while that void of nothingness is looming over the town as kind of just a big money dump. When they finish that, who knows? Maybe the city of Detroit will be ready. But no, not right now.
Well, I mean, they are holding the NFL draft this April, so they. I mean, the leagues are clearly starting to feel better about Detroit. WWE held SummerSlam there this summer. I think there's a possibility that it could happen. Obviously, next year is San Francisco. The year after that is going to be in LA and the Clippers' new Intuit Dome or whatever they're calling it when that's going to be done. But with the Pistons having one of the newer arenas, the thing is, though, you know, and you've been to LCA, it's like the Pistons are renting there, you know? This is the Red Wings arena, clearly.
It was built for hockey, it was.
Yeah, and when you get there, you know, there's just very little to do with the Pistons when you walk in there. But I don't know how you solve that or if you ever do, but I don't think the Pistons will ever have their own arena.
But I would counter by saying this. The Pontiac Silverdome was built for football. Pistons made it their own. But by the time the Pistons moved out of the Silverdome, it was very much the Detroit Pistons arena, not the Detroit Lions arena. That's because of one thing, because the Pistons got very, very good, and they made that arena their home, and fans knew that arena for hosting an NBA Finals. Even though I know it did host the Silverdome, but it never the Lions never made a great run until, you know, aside from one year. Like it was one of those big domes that you knew from basketball because you were seeing Magic and Isaiah and Bird in the playoffs every year. I mean, that's what you knew it for.
Yeah.
So I want to say that there is still potential for the Pistons to make LCA a basketball hub. And, you know, don't forget two different playoffs because of the Silverdome was unusable. The Pistons played playoff games in Joe Louis Arena in Detroit. You know, one of their most memorable playoff games in Pistons history was 1984 against the Knicks in Joe Louis Arena. In 1985, Vinnie Johnson, the game where he became the microwave, Joe Louis Arena. And yeah, it was made for hockey, but the compact atmosphere made it great for the fans. The atmosphere was incredible both times. So I think there's still some hope there.
I guess we'll see in the future. But speaking of this year's All-Star Game, which was held at Gamebridge Arena in Indiana, I will be
so many names.
Yeah, it's always changed, but I will be in Indiana next week for the NFL Combine, and there is talk of me possibly going to my first Pacers game on either Monday or Wednesday. They're going to play the Raptors on Monday, and then the Pelicans on Wednesday. The tickets there, Keith, are incredibly cheap for a team that's good. Like
But they don't draw well at all.
$8. $8.
And Indiana is a huge bad. They pride themselves on being a basketball state, but the Pacers have been bad for so long. I think it's still very much a college basketball state and a high school basketball state. I think it stopped being an NBA basketball state when Reggie Miller retired, to be honest with you. But
we'll see.
I have attended Pistons games there twice.
Once in 2004, once in 2005, just after the brawl, which was an experience. But it is a outstanding place. Like, it was built for basketball. You can tell, like, the acoustics. I've never noticed acoustics for a basketball game before, but it's just everything sounds great. The sight lines are all awesome. It is still, and the arena's, I think, 24, 25 years old now. It reminds me very much of the Palace, how it just aged gracefully and it never ever felt old.
Well, we'll see. We'll see if I wind up actually doing that, and I'll let you guys know next time we're on an episode here. But that's going to do it for us today in the All-Star Talk. I think our next episode will probably be our final redraft, right?
Yeah, it's a long time coming, and then we'll have our redraft recap at not the same week, but we'll, you know, maybe a month later we'll do our redraft recap once we have, well, at least once I've had time to pour over the numbers.
I'm really looking forward to that, because it would be nice to relive all those things. That was one of the reasons I wanted to start doing the show, is to do these redrafts, because I love them so much. But who knows? Maybe we'll just do them again. No, I'm not going to do that. We're not going to do that. We're going to come up with some other stuff, and we'll have other offerings for you, obviously. And we'll have tons of fun things and some more guests, and we're trying to get some more NBA players on the show, and we'll make that happen eventually. But until then, 2022 NBA draft coming up next week. We'll see you guys then.